If you've done a mindfulness, meditation, or other mental wellness course at work, what was that experience like? Did it make a difference? You can head to our Facebook page too and pop a comment there and tell us how it went for you and whether you felt it made a difference. Mindfulness or wellness sessions are increasingly being offered in the workplace. Let's look at how useful they are and the evidence base that they might be drawing on. Nicholas Van Dam is the director of the Contemplative Studies Centre and an associate professor at Melbourne University. Nicholas, welcome back to Life Matters.
Thanks.
And Rachel Clements is an organisational psychologist and director of psychological services at a company called the Centre for Corporate Health. Rachel, welcome to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. Nicholas Van Dam, let's define mindfulness if we can and how it might intersect with our definition of meditation as well.
Sure. So mindfulness is used as a term in a lot of different ways. The most common definition is one that was provided by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who is kind of considered to have popularized the idea in the West starting in the late 1980s. So Jon Kabat-Zinn says it's the awareness that arises through paying attention. And so it's this idea that you're becoming more aware of what's going on, what you're experiencing, by very specifically attending to something. And the way in which you're doing that, you're attending things, is on purpose. So it's something that you do intentionally. It's not something that happens to you. It's not something that's an accident. You have to kind of go out of your way to cultivate it. It's in the present moment. So it's this idea that we're trying to be where we are. And it's non-judgmentally. And the idea about that non-judgment component is that we're trying to just be open to experience. So whether it's good, bad, somewhere in between, boring, neutral, we're just open to it, whatever it is. So that's the definition that Jon Kabat-Zinn gives. But there's a bit of fuzziness and there's a bit of debate about that. Now, that gets talked about, that this idea of mindfulness gets talked about in the context of mindfulness activities or exercises. It gets talked about in meditation. It gets talked about in a number of other contexts. And so there's a lot of fuzziness as to what we mean. And there is a particular form of meditation that is mindfulness meditation. And so meditation, it represents a whole other host or set of activities. So mindfulness meditation is a formal practice whereby one is actually trying to cultivate or create mindfulness.
And the meditation aspects can be drawn from various different longer-term spiritual traditions too, can't they? They might have other aims, like spiritual aims.
Absolutely. And look, that's where from where mindfulness and the way that Jon Kabat-Zinn talks about it, where it's coming from originally is Buddhism. And the goal there is actually something like enlightenment. And meditation as a term actually comes from Christianity. And so the goal there often is sort of, you know, communion with God. So many forms of meditation often have as a goal some connection with something much bigger, something spiritual. And some forms of meditation also just have as a goal a sense of, you know, greater focus, greater attention. So there's a wide variety of goals that are associated with meditation practices.
Rachel Clements, when we think about the courses that your organization runs, do they draw on those definitions specifically?
Yes, certainly. When the programs that we run are generally provided to our corporate workplaces, where workplaces may realise that we might have a leadership population or an employee population that may be struggling with aspects of their well-being. So what we tend to do in our program is definitely work on some of those aspects that Nicola was talking around, certainly increasing people's self-awareness of where they are in their own well-being or their own mental health, whether it might be increased focus or attention if their prefrontal cortex is feeling very tired and depleted. But in our programs, we also infuse a whole lot of really holistic resilience or well-being strategies, very influenced by some of the work of cognitive behavior therapy or neuroscience or acceptance and commitment therapy, adult learning principles. So we're embedding a really holistic framework to give people an evidence base. We are very, very strong in whatever we are providing our clients. Definitely comes from a strong evidence base, but also infusing it to make it really practical. How do I use this tool in the workplace? If I'm feeling overwhelmed, what can I do in this moment that might calm me down and reduce my anxiety a little? So we're trying to combine the evidence base with the practicality to increase people's coping resources and coping skills.
So it can be tailored for particular workplaces and draw on different kind of strands and ideas about what constitutes mental resilience or mental wellness, yeah?
Absolutely. I think that is really the key. It's not a one size fits all. every program that we design for our clients is really based on their unique psychosocial risk factors that are emerging. And probably the biggest ones that most of our clients are speaking to us around now, for example, for leaders, it's very much around how they are traveling at the moment. There's very high levels of burnout among our leadership population. Everyone seems to be really struggling with the concept of managing hybrid teams. So we're doing very tailored programs around those two psychosocial risks for leaders. And for staff at the moment in our workplace population, it's definitely dealing with the concept of ambient stress. This constant level of stress that we've got just bubbling below the surface that we've become so used to and accustomed to in the last couple of years. I would say anxiety is probably the number one emotion of 2022. Mm. And also the staff now dealing with, well, how am I now getting into new routines when I'm now asked to come back into work and adjusting to that change yet again?
So, Rachel, could you give us an example of what might happen in one of the sessions that you run, particularly focused on staff rather than leadership?
Yes. For example, if it's a staff session, obviously for us, we're always really inspired by getting behaviour change for people. So the longer the program, the better. In our corporate space, we're heavily influenced by people's time. Some programs we may do, it might just be we have a lunch and learn session that we'd love to give our team to help them with their struggles that we know that they have at the moment. For others, it might be we really want to invest quite heavily. We may even be able to have, you know, 2x2-hour sessions, which we like to do over a period of time. I think if we're really talking around real behavior change, it's around trying to do small amounts of information over a longer time period. But concepts that we might introduce in our current programs for anxiety or dealing with that ambient stress and burnout are certainly things such as really looking at giving them self-awareness of where they are on their own well-being. So that includes a little bit of that mindfulness-based awareness and focus. We are very heavily influenced by that cognitive flexibility and cognitive adaptability, giving people those skills to be able to reframe situations that may come towards them. It might be increasing their level of optimism or emotional regulation strategies, helping people to teach them techniques to boost their self-efficacy or their locus of control, being really mindful of how they're using their energy at the moment. Are they dipping that into a whole lot of negative emotion, or are they able to be more aware and more conscious around their levels of emotion and maybe use a whole lot of positive emotion techniques as well? It could be increasing their social support as well, or even their stress tolerance to negative emotions.
We're speaking today with Rachel Clements, who's an organisational psychologist and director of psychological services at a company called the Centre for Corporate Health. They run courses within companies and organisations that are focused on things like mindfulness and resilience and helping people cope better at work. Nicholas Van Dam is with us too. He's the director of the Contemplative Studies Centre and an associate professor at Melbourne University. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, whether you've done one of these courses at work that's designed to help you with your well-being generally, and what effect that you feel it had. Our ABC Radio National Facebook page is the place to leave your comment. Nicholas, if we look at the proven benefits of the practices that you talked about before, mindfulness and meditation, how do we know that they are effective when using those definitions for starters?
So I guess, well, proven's a strong word. I would say sort of we don't really prove anything in science. We sort of get evidence and we sort of support things, and science changes. And over time, sort of, you know, we may find that things that we used to think worked don't work anymore. And that's sort of often a source of frustration among the general population, is that, you know, we kind of change our minds. And that's just because that's the way that science works. But look, when we talk about mindfulness, as I described it, we know that it works reasonably well for a variety of people. As Rachel mentioned, it, you know, it's not a one size fits all thing, even with these programs. The ones that we know the most about are these structured programs. So they're often 8-week programs. They can be longer. They require sort of something like 2 to 3 weeks, 2 to 3 hours per week of getting together with a group, as well as 45 minutes of home practice almost daily. And so when we look at those practices, we know that they can have benefits across a variety of domains, including anxiety, depression, stress, and any number of things. When we start to talk about changing or modifying those programs, when we start to water them down, when we start to offer them in different formats, either online or via apps, the effect sizes get smaller, so they don't work as well.
So the kind of time time lengths that Rachel Clements has mentioned before, 1 hour or a 2x2 hour, how much effect might you see out of those?
Probably very little. You know, when there's sort of discussions that, you know, 5 minutes is all you need. And what sort of seems to be coming out, some preliminary research that we have seems to suggest that the greatest benefits seem to come from just doing this over and over repeatedly. So Rachel did mention behavior change, and certainly that is the goal. In order to really see a change in behavior, to see a change in context, you have to repeatedly do something over and over and over again. So when we look at sort of studies that do very short programs or short interventions, people may feel better in the moment. They may feel less stressed, they may feel less anxious in that moment, but that's unlikely to do a whole lot in terms of the next time they get stressed out or get anxious again. So, and that's really the big problem, you know, and the big question, I guess, is with these kinds of programs, unless we're actually teaching people how to resolve the bigger problems that they face. And I guess when we're talking about companies and corporate well-being, and we're talking about the context in which people are working, if we're not addressing the broader issues that people face, they may feel a little bit more relaxed or a little bit less stressed or a little bit less anxious in the moment. But unless the broader context changes, and unless they feel like they actually are developing the skills to deal with the problems as they arise the next time, and the time after that, and the time after that, we're probably not going to see a whole lot of benefit. And the data sort of seems to support that.
We've got a lot of texts coming in on this. Judith in Brisbane says, in my experience, mindfulness activities put the blame on employees, not stress, workload or conflict. A very effective ploy by management, says Judith. Mindfulness, says someone else, the new opiate of the masses. It makes me want to scream. Burnt out? Can't cope with the situation? Don't get rid of the negative emotions. And then in caps, use the negative emotions to drive for change. Otherwise, we all sit there in our meditative calm, blaming our individual mindsets and do nothing about things that should be different. Some strong views coming in. Rachel Clements, how do you know that the programs you're offering are effective? Are they evidence-based?
Yes, I mean, the best way is to measure it. So on the longer programs that we're able to do, so if we have a client organisation that would that does invest in longer programs, where we might be doing a series of, you know, here's three 90-minute sessions over a six-week period, or here's 2x2 hours over a six-week period, we actually do pre, sometimes during and post measures. So what we do is we can measure that change and that behaviour change to be able to show the efficacy of that behaviour change over time. What we also try to do, because it is all, as Nicholas was saying, it's really in the embedding, to look at true behaviour change, you're really looking at the constant embedding of this information over time. So that's where things like apps can be quite useful. It can be also, we also have an employee assistance program as well. So sometimes someone might be doing a corporate program with us, and sure, it might only be an hour long, and that might not necessarily give big behaviour change, but it may give one strategy, and it also might be an entry point into that further coaching or that further one-on-one assistance. So it does sometimes form a pathway into the one-on-one assistance where we're able to get, we're working much more tailored towards an individual's circumstances, and then taking good measures of the pre and the post so as that we can see what that behaviour change has been like.
So that's the kind of assessment afterwards. But when I say evidence-based, are they based on peer-reviewed scientific research? Are we certain that the methodologies that you're using are based on research?
Well, the methodologies that we are using is definitely based on evidence-based psychological concepts, such as cognitive behaviour therapy or a lot of the strategies coming out of the neuroscience research or acceptance and commitment therapy. So, yes, the evidence is definitely there for the strategies that we are providing people in our programs. And actually, upon reflection, when we are able to do longer programs and do track that behaviour change, overall, we have found very, very strong efficacy for positive behaviour change from pre-measures into post-measures. And we also run this type of a program one-on-one over 12 sessions with people. And again, the program is very tailored. Sometimes we're doing it with people who have a mental health issue and they're not feeling so great, and we use it as a strategy to get them well again. And we've taken very strong, robust measures on the one-on-one assistance, and that's been able to really show very strongly people have increased capacity for work, their depression, anxiety and stress scores have improved considerably, and it results in significant behaviour change on those one-on-one individual coaching programs.
So, Rachel, who delivers the programs? Are they all delivered by psychologists, or are there any other qualifications people need to have?
Well, for our programs, yes. So we're very strict that they must all be registered psychologists to be able to deliver these programs. We always say it's not just an information session. We're really trying to instill, even if it's one thing, and even if we're just doing a 1 hour lunch and learn, my biggest takeaway I try to give participants and our team is very much just one thing that you might take away today to shift from the knowing into the doing. And even just knowing one little thing that was better off before you came in might actually be able to make that wonderful difference. And if you practice that one thing over and over, then that might result in that little bit of behaviour change and could make a wonderful difference to your well-being.
Nicholas Van Dam, is it enough to have a psychologist offering a course like this? Because there can occasionally be harms emerging from various kinds of meditation and mindfulness, can't there? Do you need someone with particular qualifications?
Yeah, look, it depends on what you're doing, right? I think there's this common idea that sort of mindfulness comes within, or, you know, we're not necessarily talking about mindfulness, we're talking about wellness as a whole, but mindfulness is this idea that it is owned or is within the purview of psychology. And it's not, as we talked about earlier on, you know, the original idea comes from Buddhism and is inspired often by other traditions. And that's not to say that Buddhists own it, but they certainly know a lot about it. And so I think if we're talking about people teaching or training people in mindfulness or any form of meditation, you certainly would hope that people have rigorous personal experience sort of trying out and learning the techniques and knowing how to deliver them effectively. And one of the things that we often see is that that's not true. People sort of delivering meditation teaching don't always, or meditation training don't necessarily have the kind of same level of rigorous qualification, say, as what a psychologist is expected to have when dealing with mental health issues. So I think it's really great in Rachel's instance that they're saying, well, they've got psychologists present and those psychologists probably can help when issues arise. I guess there's a whole other issue that comes up, though, in terms of if you're guiding people through activities or exercises that are meditation based, you may struggle to help people resolve those, because some of those things may be issues that, you know, are sort of based on ideas about concepts really that are really big, like, you know, is the self really what you think it is? And, you know, you can give people sort of practical psychological advice about that, and you can try to help guide them through that. But I guess the real question is a psychologist the person that's going to help someone to kind of resolve the issues around what is the purpose of their life? And who are they as an individual? And do they exist the way that they think they ought to? And for some, that those kinds of probing questions can result in some serious distress and some serious sort of existential questioning as to who and what they are. So I think what we probably need sort of is somebody who has kind of training in both, you know, someone who has training in guiding meditation and practice in meditation, particularly if that's what's being used, as well as awareness of psychological issues so that they can manage those kinds of potential harms or risks, which include things like panic attacks, becoming more depressed, becoming suicidal, and even things as severe as psychotic breaks in around 5 to 8% of people when they're engaging in meditation practices. Mm.
So more texts on this. Contrary to the views of a previous texter, mindfulness is useful for the things we can't change. When we've changed the things we can and had the wisdom to know the difference, that's definitely drawing on the Christian tradition there. Another says, I worked in a stressful workplace with high need, sometimes suicidal clients. 1 hour of mindfulness over 8 weeks did give me strategies to cope better. And Laurie says, sorry, but the whole mindfulness bandwagon is just about blaming employees for under-resourcing and understaffing in the constant pursuit of more profit. That is a big question, Rachel Clements. Some employees might view making time to do these courses as just a box-ticking exercise that actually adds to their workload and is really, as you said, designed to kind of increase their self-efficacy and their resilience and their ability to be more productive at work. Is that a useful thing when you actually looking at people's holistic wellness?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think any wellbeing program or resilience program that you may be trying to introduce, it's really important that you are looking also, that the organisation is also looking at those inherent psychosocial risks that may be causing the problem in the first place. So if it is, you know, incredible organisational change or high workloads, a resilience program or a mindfulness program or a wellbeing program is not going to fix that. It may enable people to cope with that, but also you do sometimes run the risk that people feel as if, well, I'm just being told to get more resilient through this change and I've just got to get better at this. So I really think it's the messaging and the leadership messaging of these programs makes, you know, can make them wonderful success stories, or equally make them, you know, perhaps have a bit more of a negative flavour where it may feel like more of a ticker box. But I think if that leadership support is there and you're definitely serious about addressing some of those other unique psychosocial risk factors that are causing some of those stressors in the first place, then that's quite, you know, that's quite a different perspective. So I think it's all in the messaging, it's all in the setup and the leadership support and sponsorship behind these programs as well.
And not just the psychosocial focus, but the actual material focus of, as you say, workloads and resourcing. How often do you see that in your clients, that they step back and go, oh, wow, we've really seen that there's a problem with resourcing and we're going to fill that gap rather than just giving some more yoga sessions?
Yeah, I think now we are starting to work with our clients who are a lot more sophisticated about getting on top of psychosocial risks. And, you know, that can certainly be perhaps from a procedural framework or maybe a legal framework. But I really think that people are a lot more educated, organizations are a lot more educated now about the need to create mentally healthy teams, to be aware of psychosocial risks within teams as they're emerging, and to be able to be very good at putting effective measures and controls in place to protect and mitigate against potential harm that they may cause.
Really interesting conversation. Obviously, it sparked a lot of response from our listeners. Thank you both for your time today, Rachel Clements and Professor Nicholas Van Dam.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Rachel Clements is co-founder and director of psychological services at a company called the Center for Corporate Health. She's an organizational psychologist. And Associate Professor Nicholas Van Dam is director of contemplative studies, the Contemplative Studies Center at Melbourne University.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.